Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is that, believe it or not, men experience Alzheimer's disease as often as women. It turns out, though, there are more women with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia than men. That's just because there are more women on the planet because they live longer than men. So basically, us guys, we die sooner, and that's why there are more women with Alzheimer's, even though we get it just as much as they do. It turns out, too, that men get a higher occurrence of vascular dementia, which is where you're having problems with blood delivery to the brain, which is going to cause you to have the cognitive dysfunction that often comes with aging. And a different study found that brain atrophy is more common in men than women. So not only do women live longer, they seem to have brains that don't shrink as much as men's. Either way, it seems to be a good idea to take really good care of your brain and take good care of the rest of your body so that you can, like me, live to 180 or beyond. At least that's the goal. And as I like to say, I'll die trying.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's guest is Dr. Michael Fossil. He's a highly respected physician, author, lecturer, neurobiologist, and he's pretty famous, I would say, for his work around telomerase therapy as a possible treatment for, we'll just say for aging, or as I like to call it, cellular senescence. And let's see, he teaches the biology of aging at Michigan University, has written a bunch of books on ethics and aging, and he's working on bringing telomerase therapy to trials. If you don't know about telomeres or telomerase, there's a theory that your cells only have so many divisions before they run out of telomeres, and telomerase could be the secret to that. The Wall Street Journal called Dr. Michael Fossil's latest book, The Telomerase Revolution, one of the best science books of the year. And this is a book that if you're a serious biohacker, you absolutely should read. But in the meantime, just to convince yourself that you should read it, why don't you hear from the man himself, Dr. Michael Fossil. Welcome to the show, Dr. Fossil.
Hi, David. Thank you. Nice to be with you. And let's keep doing this 180 years too, please.
It's a deal. Now, when people call you Dr. Fossil, do they automatically just think that you're either really old into aging or that you work with dinosaur bones? Like, which is it?
No, and I always wished I'd been a paleontologist. It would have been a great thing to direct a museum paleontology, Dr. Fossil. I have to tell you, though, when I was a kid, there were five of us in the family. My mother was a single mom. And one Sunday morning, it was quiet around the house. And if you have five boys and it's quiet, there's problem. So she came down to the bottom of the driveway and discovered us putting up a big sign that said, 50 cents, come in, see oldest living fossil. She made us take it down.
And for the record, for people who might be searching for you on Amazon right now, it's F-O-S-S-E-L, not F-O-S-S-I-L. Still, that's awesome. The things kids do, right?
And adults too, actually.
Good
point.
It's
a great name for that.
Now, you said something amazing at the beginning of your book when I was reading it that I thought was actually worth repeating so that you could tell me why you chose this. In the book Dedication, you wrote, "To those with minds open to logic and eyes open to data, may others be as open to you as you are to the world around you. To those who, aging and suffering, hear others tell you nothing can be done, they're wrong." What made you put that in your dedication?
Well, a couple things. There are really two separate points there. One is I've discovered that a lot of people have very closed minds. And sometimes they have the right idea, but they still are sort of not thinking accurately. You see this in politics. You see it in science. You see it in a lot of things. But with regard to aging, where I see it is that people often don't focus on logic or even better on the data. They focus on their own sort of prejudices about how things work. And as usual, nature and biology and medicine is usually much more complex than people realize, but they sometimes just make a decision about what can or can't be done. And that's particularly true of aging. There's, you know, we sometimes divide diseases into a couple of categories. Those things that we think we've gotten someplace on, for example, infectious disease. Diseases that we can't do anything about, but we think we're about to, for example, some genetic diseases. And then there's still this category that people have in their heads of diseases they don't think we can do anything about. And that is almost always age-related diseases, whether it's Alzheimer's or otherwise. I'll give you an example of this. Last year, the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan was the director, put out the annual report this month last year that said it was time we give up the curative model. Well, if you give up the curative model, you're certainly not going to cure it. I mean, if we'd given up the curative model for polio in 1950, we'd still all be on iron lungs and having leg braces. I think that when somebody says you can't cure age-related diseases, what they mean is they don't know how you could do it. But I think it takes a little more imagination, a lot more logic, and some careful thinking about all this.
That's a pretty bold statement to say, just flat out cure it. It reminds me of another time in my career. I'm a computer science guy by training. I worked in Silicon Valley for a long time. And when I was getting my degree in computer information systems, they taught us really carefully, don't use the term artificial intelligence because it'll never come true. It's just too big of a thing. So use these other words like decision support systems, which is what my concentration was in my studies. Decision support systems are a part of artificial intelligence, but we would never call it that. And it's happening now with aging, where they're saying, well, don't say you'll cure aging. Oh my goodness, that could never happen. But if you look at the state of artificial intelligence now, it's actually happening, and we have self-driving cars and machines that write their own code. They actually did it. It just took them 25 years longer than they thought. Is the same thing happening with aging right now?
I think so. Somebody pointed out the quote the other day, Lord Kelvin, back about almost 200 years, said that we would never have heavier-than-air aircraft. Well, I can understand why you felt that way, because if it's heavier, it falls down. But you're neglecting the Bernoulli principle. You're neglecting aerodynamics. And from his standpoint, it made sense that there never could be a heavier-than-air aircraft. But the Wright brothers, less than 50 years later, proved him wrong. And I think that's where we are with regard to aging, too. If what you think about is a sort of a small molecular approach, you know, can we cure this with just a few chemicals? The answer is no. But if you think more carefully about how aging works, I think the answer is yes. It reminds me about that general point about aging as a disease. You know, there are a lot of biologists who would say that aging is not a disease. And to me, this is simply a matter of semantics. But what tickles me is that the very same people who tell me that aging is not a disease are dyeing their hair, getting Botox, Right. And it just goes on and on. So they act like it's a disease, but they're telling you it's not. I don't really care whether it is or isn't. The point is, I'd like to see us improve people's lives, and I think we can do it.
Now, there's so many different theories of aging. Aubrey de Grey is a friend who's famous for his, I just blanked on if it's 5 or 7. It's certainly an odd number. Anyway, main theories of aging, and telomeres are definitely something to pay attention to in that. But there's other big theories of aging. Can you walk me through some of them? I know you write about this in your book, but what are some of the historical aging theories that stand out most to you as being, interesting?
The problem with most of them is that there are some aging theories that aren't theories because you can't test them. You know, if my aging theory is that it's all caused by little green demons, if I can't prove that, then that's not a theory. It's just an interesting conversation over that glass of resveratrol and alcohol that you were talking about earlier. And that's fine, but that's not science and it's not medicine. So there are a lot of theories that are essentially not testable. But there are an awful lot of theories that fly in the face of what we know about things. I'll give you an example of this. One theory would be that all aging is just sort of a matter of entropy and things fall apart over time. Well, that's fine, except that if you think about it, you realize that the cells at the tip of my nose here are now 65 years old, and they came originally from a cell from my mother, who was 40-something when she had me. It came from her grandmother. It came from her mother. And in fact, in a very real biological sense, the cells on the tip of my nose are now 3.5 billion years old. So why did that cell line not age, and yet in a matter of 6 decades, I screw up? Why the difference? The same thing would be said with regard to mitochondrial theories of aging. It is true that mitochondria play a big role in aging. But if your theory of aging is that mitochondria just sort of fall apart after time, then you have to explain why the mitochondria in my body came from my mother, that came from her mother, and those mitochondria go roughly 1.5 billion years. So what you have to say is not that mitochondria cause aging, but that mitochondria didn't age for 1.5 billion years, and then in a matter of decades they age. Why? So what you find is that a number of these theories, they fly in the face of common observations. If what I'm doing is looking just at dogs and cats and horses and pigs and people, mammals, for example, birds, fish, they all seem to age. And yet, if you go back through the cell line and expand your view biologically, you discover that there are exceptions, things that don't age, things that do age. Common things do, but not everything does. It reminds me of physics. You know, classical physics works fine until you go down to the quantum level or up to the level of relativity, and then you find you need to expand your view. The same is true of aging. If what you're doing is just looking at dogs and cats and people, you're right. But if you expand it and look back at the germ cell line and expand your view back through time, you realize that, your explanation of aging doesn't hold water. Here's another one. There's that old explanation of how the universe is created. It sits on top of a turtle. What does that sit on? A turtle. It's on a turtle. It's turtles all the way down. Well, if what I want to do is explain aging in terms, for example, of just endocrine changes, then the question is, which endocrine gland sets the pattern? All right, name it. All right, but then what times it within that endocrine gland? Is it turtles all the way down? And why is it that some animals don't age as fast as others, and certain organisms don't age? Is that all just endocrine and non-endocrine? The answer is it doesn't actually hold water. It's when you try to explain it as turtles all the way down, you're missing something. The advantage of looking at things in terms of, the disadvantage of looking at things in terms of telomerase and cell senescence is that most people actually don't understand. And I understand it's complex. The advantage is that it actually is consistent with all the data. And furthermore, when we intervene, it works. That is, we can reset aging in human cells, human tissues, and as far as we can tell, somewhat in people.
Now I've just finished writing a book about mitochondria. And there's pretty good evidence, and we can measure mitochondrial efficiency, and there's pretty good evidence that 48% of us before age 40 have early onset mitochondrial deficiencies. In other words, it's like the engine in your car, it blows a gasket, it still runs, just doesn't run quite as well as it did. So the efficiency of energy production goes down over time. And over 40, almost everyone is making less energy per rotation of the Krebs cycle because they're leaking electrons somewhere. And I know that you can hack that. And when you do, you get immediate performance improvements and many of the neurological diseases of aging go away. Doesn't mean that it makes you live forever. It doesn't mean it cures aging, but it seems like it's an important variable. Do you support that view, or is it even less important in your view of things?
Well, it is important, but you're still not looking back far enough fundamentally and asking yourself why that happens. So if we look more carefully, for example, at mitochondrial function, and particularly with the aerobic with Krebs cycle, what you find is that all of the enzymes that are responsible for the aerobic portion of the Krebs cycle derive not from mitochondria, but from the nucleus. And what we've seen is that if you look at the rate at which those are turned over, because it's a dynamic process, you don't just get an enzyme that sits there for 100 years. Mm-hmm. No, it's continually coming apart and being replaced by new enzymes. So there's a turnover process. And what you find is that if you look at the enzymes that are supplied from the nucleus, they begin to be downregulated as the telomere shortens. So what you're finding is that the turnover rate in your mitochondria goes down. So let me give you an example. Let's say that any of your listeners work in a great big building, and they have a budget, a maintenance budget of $100,000 a year to clean the floors, clean the windows, do the carpets, but they decide to save money and they cut it back to $10,000 a year. You got the same rate, same cleaners, they just don't come in as often. They're very efficient, they come in every 2 weeks rather than every day. And likewise, the soap is the same and the vacuums are the same. The amount of dirt is the same, but the whole building begins to look dingy solely because you've turned down the maintenance budget. That's what's happening with mitochondria. You're turning down the rate at which you're turning things over. You're not cleaning things up as fast. So the outcome is, as you've already said, if I look at a whole mole of sugar I put in and I ask how many ATP I get for that, the answer goes down. If I ask how many reactive oxygen species I create, the answer goes up. And it's worse than that because the same thing is true of the bilipid membrane that holds the mitochondria together. And what it does is sequesters reactive oxygen species. So not only are you making more, but now the lipid membranes aren't being turned over as fast. Again, that's not just a static membrane. They're continually being turned over. So they get leakier. And not only are they leaking, but then once they get out there, you trap reactive oxygen species, urate, superoxide dismutase, catalase. You have a number of compounds. But the ones that you create in your cells, for example, SOD and catalase, turn down also. So the efficiency of trapping those escaped mitochondria go down, and then your efficiency of repairing the enzymes you destroy, the protein damage because of reactive oxygen species go down. So you make more reactive oxygen species, you leak in your membranes, you don't trap them, and you don't repair the damage, and all of those ultimately go back to changes within the nucleus. So the mitochondria plays a huge role, but it's because of what's happening in the nucleus that the mitochondria fails.
So that is a part of the equation, but it's also because of what happens in the environment around us. Like we have epigenetics, we have of what happens even in the nucleus of the cell is controlled by the environment around you. In other words,
exactly.
Yeah, right. If you don't get like the circadian component, the idea that your mitochondria are derived from bacteria. They had a night and they had a daytime. And you get bright lights at night, you get mitochondrial dysfunction. You probably also get endocrine dysfunction higher up in your brain and all of that. So it seems like there's this really complex interaction between our genetics and our nuclear DNA and with the environment. And you're saying that that also then influences telomeres and influences your mitochondria, which is why aging is such an ugly problem to hack, right?
Oh yes. I have never said that telomeres cause aging. I'm not sure that the word cause makes a lot of sense.
Fair point.
Where do you intervene? It's a practical issue for me. But let me put that whole epigenetic issue in context because you're absolutely right. First of all, if I look at all of your genes and I ask how many genes actually express proteins that actually go on and do something in your cell, the answer is about 1.5%. And then if I look at the rest of your genes and ask myself, what do they do? We know that at least 30 to 40% of your genes actually are regulatory. So what that tells you is that approximately 30 times as many genes are involved in regulating genes as they are involved in actually making important proteins. So the genes that actually do the work, the protein-producing genes, are a very tiny component, and everything else controls them. So that's why the difference between my hair cells and my toe cells is not genetic, it's regulatory. It's what's expressed. The same thing is true with regard to aging. The difference between me at age 6 and me at age 65 is not different genes. It's all epigenetic. It's all just the way they're expressed. Now, what you've done is begged an interesting question, which is, well, that's nice, but what controls the epigenetic change? So you've already alluded to telomere shortening, and that's fine, but why does that happen? And the answer is the rate of telomere shortening depends a lot on what you do. Example, if I'm a professional basketball player and I jump up and down on my knees all day, I'm killing off chondrocytes. They're being replaced by the other chondrocytes there, and those cells are dividing. So in short, they're aging faster, which is why old basketball players have worse osteoarthritis than old yoga people. The same is true with everything else. Do you smoke? Do you have night shifts? Do you go out in the sun and get a sunburn? Are you exposed to radiation? It just goes on and on. So that brings us back to the interesting question about what causes aging, and the answer is, depends what you mean by cause. It's like, what causes this podcast? Well, what are you asking? What level are you wanting an answer here? And that's why, again, I think from my perspective when it comes to aging, the question isn't so much what causes it, is where can you intervene?
Yeah.
Causation.
How do you hack it?
Yeah. Causation is like little kids asking why. It's sort of a slippery concept, and it's usually intellectually lazy. What you need to do is specify what you mean and what can we do about it.
So what can we do about aging then? In fact, you know, I want to ask you that question, but I realize some listeners may not really know what telomeres are. And I gave a very back of the envelope perspective, but you have been studying them for decades. Can you define telomeres and telomerase so people have a really good picture of it in their head? And then let's talk about what you can do about it.
Well, the usual analogy, and it's not a good one in some ways, but the usual analogy is that little plastic sleeve at the end of your shoelace, if anybody has shoelaces these days, called the aglet. There's even a song about that from Phineas and Ferb, I think. But in any case, they are the last several thousand base pairs at the end of each chromosome. And what's interesting is that as cells divide, they shorten. But what's more important is as they shorten, they affect the pattern of gene expression throughout the rest of your chromosomes. So they act in some ways like a clock. By the way, they don't unravel. I've heard that before at various times in various places on some medical TV shows. They don't unravel. They just shorten. It also doesn't matter what the length is. The question is, what's the change in length? That's why some mice have telomeres that are 10 times longer than ours typically, and yet they have lifespans that are typically 20 times shorter than ours. So it's not the length, it's the change in length, and it's what that does to the pattern of gene expression. Back to what you said about epigenetics. Epigenetics sort of is everything. I sometimes kid that people are worried about genes are involved in 20th century medicine. Very bright people, but that's 20th century medicine. 21st century medicine is epigenetics. It's much more complex than we realize, much more important. So what's going on is that as the telomere shorten, it changes the pattern of gene expression, it changes the tune that the orchestra plays, and the result is that we begin to fail and get diseases. So the question is, what happens if you use telomerase to reset it? Well, that was first done 17 years ago. We can do that in human cells, and when you do that, you reset the entire pattern of gene expression, and the cells act like young cells. It was first done in human tissues 16 years ago. Works fine. The question is, can we do it to people, and will it have the clinical results that we think it will? And the answer is, we're about to find that out.
What do you predict will happen in those studies?
Well, what I predict is a couple of things. One is the major worry, which I will pass by right now unless you want to get back into it, has been cancer. And the answer is no, actually, telomerase appears to be more protective against cancer than causing. Now, there are some interesting little exceptions. As ever, things are complex. But in a very general way, you're less likely to get cancer if you have a long telomere than if a short telomere. because it upregulates, for one thing, that longer telomeres upregulate DNA repair. Good. But the other thing is what happens to cells and tissues, and the answer is they begin to act like more young cells and young tissues. As I said, this was first done in human tissues 16 years ago, and what you find is that you can, for example, take old human skin cells and grow young human skin. So don't tell me you can't reverse aging. That was done at least 16 years ago. The question is, can we do it in you? And that's a different question. We have a number of ways to do that. I can think of about four or five right off the bat, some of which probably are technically very hard to do. And there are a number of targets we could use. We're going to go after Alzheimer's disease for a number of strategic reasons. So that's our first target.
Why Alzheimer's disease?
Well, let me put it this way. Say I have an experimental gene therapy, and I tell you I can get rid of some wrinkles with it, but we're not sure of the side effects. It's an experimental gene therapy. My response would be, that's nice, you know, in a couple of years, because I don't want to take the risk. Now, say I say to you, also, you've got osteoarthritis in both knees, and we can give you a knee replacement. We can put you on Motrin. We can tell you good luck. Would you like to try an experimental gene therapy? And again, practically speaking, my personal answer would be, let me know how it works for a year or two and talk to me again, but not today. Because there are alternatives. You know, you can always get a knee replacement. I'm not recommending it personally, but yeah. It's, you know, it's painful. It's got risks of its own. And yet, what else could you do? But when it comes to Alzheimer's, the answer is there is no alternative. Alzheimer's is 100% fatal. You know, the average time to death is 8 years. People vary a lot. The only reason you don't die of Alzheimer's is if something else kills you first, like pneumonia. And there are literally no drugs that really affect Alzheimer's. There are some 5 drugs in the global market. None of them have ever been shown to have any effect on the course of the disease. There are a number of drugs in FDA trials right now, and although they've been shown to have some effect on things like beta amyloid or mitochondrial function, none of them have ever been shown to affect the course of the disease.
Nutritional ketosis seems to affect the course of it pretty dramatically. Like Dominic D'Agostino's been on the show a couple times. It seems like we've made some progress there.
I don't think so. Just say I disagree.
That'll be a fascinating conversation. We probably won't cover it in this interview, but we might have to have you back on. Maybe I get, that's cool. So I respect your will to just put it out there the way it is. So, okay, cool. I didn't expect that you would.
Let me put it, let me give you a different thing, though. Let me just say that I think we can cure Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, yeah, we can.
And very few people would say that. For example, if I go to the Alzheimer's Association website, you'll find one of their web pages says that their goal is to help people learn to live with Alzheimer's.
Terrible.
Not me. I'd like to let people learn to live without Alzheimer's.
Damn straight.
And I think it's doable. And I think it's doable within 2 years.
Wow. Within 2 years. Because of the therapies you're working on?
Yes.
Wow. Well, Godspeed to you on those, because that's a game changer. And part of my goal at Bulletproof is to meaningfully reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's through basically epigenetics. There's things you can do that set yourself up to get Alzheimer's. You just do them 20 years before you get it. So you can either delay or prevent it just by making lifestyle changes much earlier.
No, I agree. In fact, let me come back with a couple of historical precedents. This one is not exactly parallel, but it's pretty close. And that is polio. You know, if I go back to 1950 and I said, what are you going to do to keep your kids from getting polio? People would talk about avoiding public pools, avoiding large social gatherings. There was a book that was a bestseller in 1952 in the United States that was called Diet Conquers Polio. Well, there was a reason for that. I don't believe that diet conquers polio, but I am pretty convinced that probably if you have a terrible diet and therefore a weakened immune system, you probably have a better chance of getting polio. But given a choice between a good diet and a polio vaccine to prevent polio, I'd go with a polio vaccine. Perfectly in favor of diet, but if I really want to prevent it, I'd take the vaccine. However, if I was in 1952, I'd be focusing on diet, I'd be focusing on public pools, I'd be focusing on a lot of things. That's where we are with regard to Alzheimer's disease. You know, I know someone who I diagnosed with ALS, and he went off to a snake bite clinic, and he asked me, did I think it would work? And my answer was, no, I don't think so, but were I in your shoes, I'd go to the snake bite clinic. Yep. There's so many things like that with regard to Alzheimer's disease. There is, I think, commercially right now available, nothing that will cure Alzheimer's disease, but I would be trying everything I could think of, whether it was exercise, meditation, you name it. Not because I think it will absolutely work, but because what have you got?
Yeah, a lot of, so biohacking is this concept that I've popularized. And the gist of it is you change the environment around you and inside you so that you have more control of your own biology. And I felt like I had nothing left to lose in my mid-20s because I had 300 pounds, my brain wasn't working, I had like massive cognitive dysfunction, arthritis in my knees since I was 14, and I'm like, I feel like I'm old, feel like I'm dying, and I'm 29, they tell me I'm going to have a stroke and a heart attack. So I'm like, all right, I got nothing to lose, I'm going to hack this. And I spent $500,000 in 15 years and became known in anti-aging and things like that. For the exact same mindset you have there. You're like, oh, I have Alzheimer's. I have X amount of years. I might as well try everything. Because if I don't try everything, I know what's going to happen. And I felt that way as a young man, which informed a lot of what I do today. That mindset is something that I think a lot of people maybe don't have, even when they have terminal cancer, when they have Alzheimer's, when they have ALS. Are you seeing a change in patients or just in the population where people are more willing to experiment because they realize they're facing the end?
Well, yes. I think that in some sense has always been true, but there have been some remarkable changes in the stress in people's lives. You know, the other day I was looking at an old Cary Grant movie from 1940, whatever it was, and we've all seen old movies like this. where the banker, for example, the generic banker with gray hair, everybody's looking up to this banker and he runs the bank, he's a remarkable person. And you go online to find out how old he actually is, and you discover that he is 45 years old, and you would swear he's 85. Well, that we've all seen people in old movies who look older than you and I would have thought they looked these days. Some people don't think I look 65. But the point is, they live different lifestyles. The stresses involved in those lives in those days were different. They almost all tended to be smokers. They were probably heavier drinkers than most of us are right now. They had different lifestyles. We all have stress. But the stresses involved in those people's lifestyles were different than ours. The epigenetics were different. Their genes were the same. You know, the genes of your parents and your grandparents weren't any better than ours. But it's what you talk about, biohacking. Leading a better lifestyle, whatever that may be, is a good idea. People have sometimes said to me, how can I live longer, healthier lives? And they expect me to say, I've got this one little thing I give you right here. It's going to solve everything. No. The answer is the same advice that your grandmother gave you that you didn't pay any attention to. Your doctor gave it to you, didn't pay any attention to him, and he cost too much. But it's that same standard advice. You know, eat well, exercise well, avoid people with loaded weapons, fasten your seatbelt. I mean, this is not sexy advice. It's not terribly difficult, but it's not something that most people do. And yet, there is a cultural change, I think, in favor of doing things like this. I remember when I started practicing medicine 30 or so years ago, I tried to avoid telling people to take up yoga because it was a religion. Well, now it's okay. I can say this. I don't have to say stretching exercises. I can say yoga. But things have changed. You know, there's an acceptance of this as a standard part of your care for yourself. A better diet, whatever that may be, a better exercise program or stretching, yoga, meditation. Those things were sort of no-nos back in the 40s, last century.
So we've definitely shifted there. Let's go back to telomeres. So you talked about what they are. How are we going to go about changing telomere length, or like how? Kind of walk me through the types of therapies that you're looking at for this.
Well, there are a couple of them. What you've got is there's an enzyme. It's actually a two-part enzyme, but it's an enzyme in your body, in each of your cells, and it's created from a gene. So all of your cells have this gene. It's usually turned off. And so some of your cells occasionally make little bits of telomeres, but generally you don't as an adult. And the question is, how can we either turn it back on or provide telomeres? So there are a number of ways. You could say, let's find something that turns on the gene, a telomerase activator. And there are some on the market. And there's some on the market that may not be what they're cracked up to be, but they're out there. You could also say, well, never mind turning on the gene. Let's just put in another gene. That sounds sort of like taking a sledgehammer to a fly, but maybe that's the approach you need to take. Another approach would be to say, you know, never mind the gene, let's put in the telomerase, which is fine if you can get it into the cells without it being destroyed. That is, can I administer telomerase by vein or mouth and get it, and not so easy. Another way would be halfway between the gene itself and the protein, there are messenger RNAs. Could I put one in that tells your body, create this? And the answer is, yes, that works fine in the lab. It's very fragile sort of molecule. And there's at least one or two other possible ways, but those are the big four. The telomerase activators, as I say, have been available on the market now. So let's see, 2007, I think the first one came on the market. We're talking about astragalocytes.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of interesting evidence, not overwhelming, but good evidence, that they have an effect on the age process in a number of clinical ways. For example, blood pressure, blood glucose control, osteoporosis, inflammatory changes, goes on and on, immune function. And none of the data is overwhelming. It's not like somebody suddenly went from being an 80-year-old to a 20-year-old, but there are significant changes, and they're interesting. I think most of us in this field would say that those changes, while they're there, they're probably only about 5% as effective as what we're trying to get. The other approach is genetic. Go ahead.
It's also very expensive. For 2 years, I took about 250 milligrams of very high potency astragalus extract every day. It was about $500 a month for the form I was taking. And if I was taking the most common brand, it would have been like $5,000 a month for whatever the dose was. Maybe my hair got a little bit less gray. But man, I'm not really sure. It was a lot of money. And there are many other supplements I take where you can feel and see a difference more powerfully than you can, at least than I could with that supplement from that source. And I'm a little bit skeptical that the bang for the buck is there. I mean, that costs as much as growth hormone, which I know you're also not a fan of at all. But it costs as much as some of the other big gun approaches to being more youthful. Do you take that stuff? Do you take astragalus?
I do, but I have the advantage of having it given to me. There are at least three issues with taking it. The first is, does it work? And the answer is probably not dramatically, but probably yes. The second question is, how much does it cost? You've already alluded to, and the answer is far more than most of us would like to, unless we're absolutely sure it was going to turn our lives around and make us healthy. Still, it's a lot. Third question is are you getting astragalus or not? Are you getting, you know, estradiol, for example? And the answer is, one, if you pick it up from an herbal store, for example, in Chinatown, the answer is it doesn't seem to be much effective estradiol present in the root that you get. There are certain sources that I think are probably highly reliable, and there are others that I can't comment on because I just don't know. I'm fairly certain, as a guess, just knowing human nature, that there are a number of sources out there on the internet that are ineffective and they're taking your money and providing nothing useful. I don't know that that's true. That strikes me as typical human behavior in any commercial enterprise. you know, my strong feeling is that the TA65 provided by TA Sciences is probably the real thing. It probably is effective. And I think I've got good reason to think that. It's certainly what was used for the scientific studies. Mm-hmm. But still, those same three questions. Does it work? How well? How much does it cost? And am I really getting the compound I want? Those are realistic questions. Not easy for anybody out there.
So for a listener listening to this, and there's probably somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 people will hear this interview, some portion of them are easily able to spend $500 a month. It's a small portion of them. And there are some others who could probably do it if they made some cuts, and others who are like, yeah, it's not on the table right now. I've got a family to feed, and you know, I can get a little bit of ketosis in my life without changing my bills at all. So there's a broad spectrum. For the people who can spend 500 or whatever more or slightly less per month to do it, do you think that it's a good idea to start taking the high potency astragalus extracts?
Well, you put it exactly right. It depends. What you're doing is you're taking a bet. You're betting that that's really the astragalus side that's active. You're betting that it works, and you're comparing that to the amount you spend. And if I had $20 million and was not the least bit concerned about paying my mortgage, my health insurance, but yeah, I'd probably do it in a heartbeat. Okay. And I'd pick the most reliable source I could find, and I wouldn't bat an eye. But that's not true of most of us.
It's
not. A lot of us are trying to figure out how to cover the rent, what to do with the recent changes in healthcare costs and the cost of a million other things. And the answer is, I can't. Even if you believed it worked, even if you knew it was a reliable source, you can't afford it. So that's reality.
One of the functions
I'd like to do something better than that.
One of the functions of this show is to bring attention to the really expensive stuff so that the cost will come down dramatically. Like if there's enough demand for things like this, the cost drops by orders of magnitude over the course of 5 or 10 years. So I would hope that because of this conversation, 5 years from now, instead of $500 a month, it's $100 a month, or better yet, you disrupt the heck out of it and you tell us what you're about to tell me, which is what you could do that's more potent. So what's above this?
Well, you know, you're exactly right. I got involved with early progeria kids back 30 years ago, 40 years ago now. And these are the kids who at age 7 look like they're 70 years old. And I used to know them all. We'd get together once a year with these kids. Now, in a typical year, you'd have 3 or 4 dozen kids globally that you knew about with progeria. And if I had a drug that cost $36 million to make, which is actually cheap these days, that would be $1 million a kid. Nobody can afford it. On the other hand, if I've got a world population of, you know, billions of people, and it cost me billions of dollars to put it together, and that's $1 a person, that's not bad. It's that market question. You know, have we got enough people out there to make it so that we can afford to treat this? And aging is not an orphan disease.
So what are we going to do about it?
Well, you know, I look at the cost of putting together the gene therapy that we're going to try for Alzheimer's disease. And without getting into the specific numbers, for example, when I do the Alzheimer's trial with 12 patients, probably starting about a year from now, the major single cost will be putting together the gene therapy, not the actual administration or the patient care. It's actually creating the initial run of the gene therapy. As it turns out, the cost drops to about 40% of that as soon as I open that up to dozens and dozens of people rather than just the first dozen. That's before you even begin to pull in technical changes in our ability to create these things. So the cost drops dramatically. Now let me compare the kind of cost you're looking at in caring for Alzheimer's disease. You know, typically right now, a month of good quality Alzheimer's care, it's not atypical for those to run $10,000 to $15,000 a month. Okay, that's a lot of money. I can't afford it. You can't afford it. In fact, globally, we can't afford it. But those are the same arguments people had in 1950. I'm serious. When they were talking about the cost of iron lungs rehabilitation and leg braces for polio victims in the year 2000, the estimate was that it would break the bank globally. Well, polio is not expensive these days. It's a very small part of the world health budget. And I think that's where we're going with Alzheimer's disease. You know, we're going to start by being able to say, listen, instead of spending an average of, say, $60,000 or $100,000 a year on nursing home care for Alzheimer's, what if we spent $40,000 initially and get rid of the whole thing? What if we lower that cost even further by having more people and being able to do this as a mass treatment? So maybe you get down to the cost of $500 once every 10 years to prevent you from getting Alzheimer's. Now you're beginning to talk about something that we might be able to afford.
That's exactly how it works. The same is true. And it sounds weird, but same as you look at your cell phone, right? It's got amazing compute capacity in it that exceeds the world's compute capacity 30 years ago. And I think I've got my numbers there, maybe 35 years ago, but something like that, where it's just kind of boggles the mind and the cost is almost nothing, whereas we're putting tens or hundreds of millions of dollars into building those early computers. So the difference is shocking. It's happened with polio and it will happen with diabetes, cancer, and Alzheimer's, but it seems like it's happening really damn slowly right now compared to the amount of tech we have. Why is it so slow?
Dave, I agree with you. And let me, actually, this becomes a very personal issue for me because I'm going to try to avoid naming names here, but the principle comes through. There's somebody I like who has been involved in trying to take the same approach to a one-off treatment offshore and avoid the FDA. And the thought would be move faster. And I agree with this because here I am already talking about being 2 years away from being able to demonstrate I'll be able to cure Alzheimer's disease. And that means an awful lot of people will die in 2 years. On the other hand, if this person is correct, what will happen is no one will believe the results because it's only one person at a time. This person was sort of in middle age when it happened. And the measurements that they're doing may not affect anything about Alzheimer's disease. So if I'm either a national healthcare system, you pick your country, or a major insurer, you pick your insurer, or a clinic, hospital, a physician, would I believe the results? And the answer is no. So the risk is that this person will go on to do something that may be effective, but since no one will find credibility in it, it'll end up costing $5 million, say, per treatment, and they'll only be able to treat a dozen people who have the $5 million or several dozen, whatever they find worldwide. I'd rather take a little longer, which disturbs me because I don't want it to take so long, but be able to get to the point where it only costs a couple of $100 and I can treat everybody.
What does gene therapy look like? Like, how would a patient go in, assuming that it works and there's clinical trials, like how would it be administered?
Well, there are a number of ways. I mean, ultimately, we may be able to administer this with just a nasal inhalation. But typically right now, what we would do is an IV administration. In our example, we're probably going to do this through a lumbar puncture, only because it's about 80 times cheaper. And that's a big amount. And it matters to us. So you end up giving it as a shot, and that's about it. We monitor you for a couple of weeks. In the FDA trial we're planning on doing, we'll be monitoring you for a minimum of 6 months and see how people do. And, of course, following up beyond that, we anticipate seeing changes within a matter of months with our treatment. But it would be, in this case, a lumbar puncture, kind of like getting a spinal tap.
I had a lumbar puncture to have my own stem cells injected into my cerebral spinal fluid to help my brain stay young, probably to deal with some traumatic brain injuries, as well as chemical brain injuries, just because I plan to live to 180. What do you think about stem cells?
I think that, you know, that all of medicine is changing. You know, I just became the editor-in-chief of a new geriatric journal, and one of the things that we're focusing on is not better nursing care, better social equity, but actually curing disease.
Good.
I think what's going on is that there are a number of thrusts in medicine that are just beginning. They include gene therapy, epigenetics, cell therapies in general, and stem cell therapy in particular. And these are all things that are very different from what we've been doing. Let me give you an analogy again. Let's say that I go back to medieval Europe, and the Black Death is coming. There's plague coming. Yeah. And you and I have come from the 20th century. And in fact, we know it's smallpox, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you and I, knowing something about smallpox, are trying to convince local people that if we use cowpox, we can inoculate them against smallpox and prevent them from dying of smallpox. And all the local healers are saying, well, you know, we have willow bark, and that'll keep the fever down. And we have a number of other roots and berries and herbs, all of which may work, but they don't prevent smallpox. And a lot of medicine up until now has been this sort of small molecular thinking. Can we find a better statin? Can we find a better, and again, these are all small molecules. And those small molecules can be very effective for things. You know, again, willow bark or aspirin may be very nice for fever and headaches, but it doesn't prevent Alzheimer's disease. It doesn't prevent smallpox. It doesn't cure Ebola. If you want to deal with some of these more complex diseases, and viral diseases come to mind, but so do age-related diseases, you have to think a little further outside the box. And you have to realize that small molecules, much as they have a great history, where would we be without penicillin maybe? But they don't do everything. And if you keep trying to look in the small molecular box for a solution to a large molecular problem that's outside the box, you're going to fail repeatedly. So what I'm really saying is that stem cells, gene therapy, and so on, this is sort of the wave of the 21st century to treat diseases that we thought we could never treat before, that we can treat and can cure.
What do you do? You're 65 years old. You're the head of a new journal on geriatrics. You've been studying aging. You're a physician. You're a neurobiologist. Walk me through a day. What do you do to stay looking as good as you look?
I get up. I meditate. I've been doing that for, I don't know, 50 years or so.
What flavor of meditation do you do?
I actually used to teach courses on this too. I used to teach yoga as well. I tend to do a Buddhist form of meditation I've been doing for 40, 50 years. I garden. That's my exercise. I've had people say, well, that's not exercise. And my response is, that's because you haven't taken 30 cubic yards of mulch and pitchforked it around the garden. And when you do that, you realize that this gardening can be a full contact body sport. I garden. And it's more than just exercise for me, obviously. It's another form of relaxation and pleasure. Not much. My exercise tends to be daily, moving up and down the stairs. Have you ever noticed how certain healthy people, if they go up the stairs, they move up very quickly and they bounce up, and other people sort of go up slowly and drag themselves up? It seems to me that many healthy people exercise sort of in their day-to-day movements. I noticed that you sitting in your chair and me sitting in my chair have not sat there quietly staring at the camera. We nod our heads, we move around, we move our arms. Sometimes exercise is more than just paying money to go to a health club.
I absolutely agree with that. In fact, I spend not a lot of my time doing formal exercise, about 15 minutes a week, but I do other things that are unusual. And what about supplements? You mentioned you take astragalus extract. I mean, do you take a fistful? I take actually three fistfuls, but like, do you use supplements?
It probably depends on which year and what my mood is. one of the things that I've been doing regularly, and I want to make fun of this in some ways, is brewery juice. And this derived from an old story about my mother during World War II, who was told she had to gain weight. And the doctor said, listen, you can either take brewer's yeast as a supplement, or you can take beer, which, of course, had a lot of vitamins in those days. She said she tasted brewer's yeast and promptly became a confirmed beer drinker. and I sometimes say I take brewer's yeast for three reasons. One is that it makes me feel good. Two is that it's pretty cheap because no one advertises it. And three is it tastes so bad, it's got to be good for you.
Have you looked at any of the studies on that form of Saccharomyces and cancer? Like, there's some pretty good relationships between brewer's yeast and baker's yeast and incidence of cancer and candida and things like that. That's one of the reasons I steer clear of it. You may have seen a lot more than I have on it.
No, but I've seen, how do I put this, some inconsistent results and some curious results. And I always tend to look, as I think we all ought to, at medical studies with sort of a jaundiced eye, not because they're wrong, but because I still remember hiring a brand new physician in our service, and probably about 3 months in, he came up with an article and said, this proves A works. And my partner and I looked and said, yes, but 2 years ago, they proved A didn't work. 5 years before that, they proved A did work. 7 years before that, they proved A didn't work. And the answer is, been there before, seen that, I'll wait for a while and see. I think the same is true of a lot of this data. It is interesting, and there probably is something in it, but sometimes the answers just aren't in. I also see the same thing with regard to telomere data particularly, where people look at the wrong thing. For example, one of the problems is that people will measure your telomeres in your peripheral white cells. Very easy to do. You get a blood sample, get a finger prick, I can measure them. The problem is that almost nobody dies of aging leukocytes. You die of aging vascular cells. You die of aging cells in your brain. You have problems with the knees because of your chondrocytes. Those aren't leukocytes. The second problem is that those things are being turned over all the time. They're churning. So if I have a lot of stress, a viral infection, a bad diet, my immune system peripherally is turning over those lymphocytes so that the peripheral lymphocytes tend to have short telomeres. If I then begin to meditate, better diet, I lower my stress, I get a dog, you name it, whatever, get some more sleep, get rid of night shifts, what you find is your telomere lengths begin to increase, but it's because you're no longer turning them over as fast peripherally. That doesn't mean you're younger. It means you're not as stressed anymore, which is good. But if I looked at your marrow cells, I'd see they're slowly still ticking away, slowly getting older. It's still good that you did all those things. But to measure peripheral lymphocytes as a measure of whole body aging is sort of like me saying, I'm going to measure one city block in the Bronx 50 years ago and today, and if now younger people live there, that means the whole country got younger. No. It means the old
great
people
analogy.
Moved out, and a bunch of yuppies moved in, and they started new businesses, and they've got a bunch of three-year-old kids. No wonder they're younger. But the rest of the country is still getting older, too.
Got it. I see that exactly. So, all right, gold standard. Now we have that same group of people listening who are happy to spend $500 a month on supplements to at least retard aging. Mm-hmm. How should they go about getting their telomeres tested? Like, what's the gold standard test?
Well, that depends on who you listen to, and it's not easy. There are at least two commercial sites that I would think about. You know, one would be Telomere Diagnostics out in California. The other would be LifeLength in Madrid. They measure slightly different things. The Madrid study is looking at average telomere lengths, and the one in California is looking at the shortest telomere lengths. Both of them tend to look at lymphocytes. So if you want to get some general measure, probably it's easier just to use Telome Health or Telome Diagnostics, Telomere Diagnostics in California. Because it's in the U.S., you don't have to ship things elsewhere. But I would just take the result with a grain of salt.
So how would a non-medical professional go about taking the results with a grain of salt? Like, what does that mean? So I have two test kits from the last A4M, the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. I went there and picked up a couple of test kits. I don't remember the name of the lab. And every time I've tried to get my blood drawn for them, it's usually like at Quest. Like, we won't fill that vial with your blood. I'm like, it's my blood in my vial. Put it in there, you bastards. Anyway,
I know.
It's a side note. So I still haven't done this because, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I probably could just fill them myself, but I'm lazy. So anyway, I don't have those results yet.
I'd happily do it for you. I'll stick you with needles anytime, Dave.
Thank you.
The Telomere Diagnostics one in California sends you one of those little needle prick things where you prick your finger and you get one drop of blood and that's it. So
that's convenient.
I think it's $89 and you could do it in the quiet of your own living room anytime.
We'll put the link on the show notes here, and I'll make sure I get the right name for that. I haven't done that one. Okay, does it work? Like would you use those results, or is it so grain of salt that it's?
Well, it's probably reliable in a sense. That is, okay. Let's say that that you're 60 years old and it comes back and suggests you've got a telomere health of 50. That's good news, as opposed to getting one back that says you've got a telomere health of 80. The problem is you really have to interpret it in terms of how's your life been going. As I say, if the last 6 months I've just been going through hell. I had divorced, my dog died, I got fired from my job, I'm on this terrible diet of eating cardboard every day plus junk food as well, then I think you can expect that those numbers are going to be unrealistically bad for you. And if what you've done is done a lot of good things, then getting confirmation that your telomeres are nice and long shouldn't surprise you. But that's why you've been doing good things for the past 5 years. So it's got some value, but it's just they tend to get overread. About once every week, there's another study out that suggests that if you eat vegetarian diet or you name it, that somehow it'll make your telomeres longer. And the answer is it might, but not on the basis of the data that you published.
So I am really interested in once a year, and I've drawn my blood, since 97. I've gotten tests about every year or so with a whole bunch of biomarkers with one of the very early A4M guys. And it's been really informative because you can make lifestyle changes and see the change in the curve. Your vitamin D levels go up when you get more sunshine. Your inflammation levels go down when you eat less omega-6 fats. And all these things you can do to get your parameters about where you want them, and you can test changes. If I get this $89 test every year, is he going to tell me whether you done good last year, son? Or is it really not going to tell me enough to be useful?
I think it will tell you whether you've done well in the last year. On the other hand, I mean, most of us, not always, but most of us already know that.
You know, good point.
You knew that when you were young and you said, I'm going straight to hell physically. And you made changes. I don't think it took any deep knowledge to figure that out. Now, having said that, some people don't. Some people suspect they're in trouble, don't want to face it, and don't want to do anything about it, and this provides an objective measure that they're in trouble, I suppose, or that they're doing well. But again, I can't help thinking what I said before is still true, which is that, your mother is cheaper, your doctor told you the same advice, and but having said that, I really do believe that telomeres are a critical measure of what's going on in terms of cell aging, but you're measuring blood cells, and you're not just blood. There's a lot more to you than just blood. So it's worth some, but it's not the be-all and end-all of aging. It just isn't.
So I'm still working on getting the big nugget for people listening to the show today. Other than maybe meditate, exercise, and eat right, what are they supposed to do, given what you know now, to influence the length of their telomeres, given that the gene therapy isn't available yet? Is there at least a directional thing you can offer besides the main lifestyle epigenetic things?
Well, again, most of it isn't sexy. And it sort of boils down to the old moderation in all things. For example, take exercise. I could go out and try to run 100 miles a week. What's the optimal for my body? And am I increasing the aging of my knees even though I'm making it better for my heart? Good question. I could have an optimal diet, whatever that is. But is that any better than a really pretty good diet? Well, I think that for me, diets are sort of like wine and coffee in some ways. I can tell the difference between a god-awful wine and an okay wine. But if it's an okay wine versus an incredibly expensive, very good wine, the answer is, all right, I'll take your report. Same thing with coffee. Same thing sort of with diets. If you have a terrible, terrible diet, you're in trouble. If you have a pretty good diet, that's good. How much better is an excellent, perfect diet than a pretty good diet? It's probably not worth all the stress you put yourself through trying to figure it all out. And as I sometimes said to people, if I could prove you could live double the lifespan by living in the basement in the dark and eating sawdust, would you do it? No, I'd have another chocolate mousse. the stress of trying to engage in a diet that just does not fit your body may be worth it in one sense, but costly in another. So it needs to be a balance between, yes, you need a pretty good diet, but after a while, chill out. I used to get these patients who'd come in and they'd say, doctor, my blood pressure is too high. I said, how do you know that? I said, well, I took it 12 times so far today. The first thing to do is to throw out your blood pressure cuff because you're already causing damage to your body if you're that nuts. And the same is roughly, again, I don't mean to overplay this, but in terms of diet, you need a good diet. But if what you do is end up stressing yourself, worrying about the whole time, you've just undercut yourself. Chill out, relax, go meditate.
There's this thing called orthorexia. And the whole point of the Bulletproof diet here, the way I recommend it is, look, know what direction perfection lies in and just lean that direction. Like, you don't have to be perfect by a long shot, but just know what direction it lies. Because a lot of people are like, I think I eat healthy. I just eat 2 cinnamon buns a day instead of 4. And you're like, well, maybe you could just tilt that a little bit better in the right way.
Yeah, and every now and then you need a glass of champagne or a piece of chocolate. But you shouldn't be drinking champagne and eating chocolate all day. My God, you know.
If you blend them with butter, it's okay.
There you go. Just... we're all nuts. Well, we're just all nuts.
We are indeed. Well, this has been a fascinating and fun interview, Dr. Fossil. I want to ask you one more question. And I think you may have already answered it, but I want to clarify it. I've asked every guest on the show this, people who are authors and researchers and various other people who've done cool things. If someone came to you tomorrow and said, based on your life's work and on your life, so basically everything you know, I want to perform better at everything I do. Like, I want to kick ass at life, at just being a human being. What are the 3 most important things I need to know? What would you tell them?
Well, the first thing is to figure out what you actually want in life. I can't tell you how many people I've run into want to be famous until they mistakenly realize that that's a disaster. I know a friend who wanted to be chairman of a department at Harvard. He became chairman of the department at Harvard, and he's unhappy. He's got a divorce. Yeah. His kids hate him. He doesn't like his job. Well, does it occur to you that the goal you had was wrong? So I think that the key for our lives many times is to pick the goal. You know, if your goal is to be the best plumber in the world, you should be that. If the goal is to raise kids that you really enjoy as part of your family, that's what you're... If your goal really is to make $10 million and that will make you happy, you go right ahead. But finding that goal is not so easy. So it's sometimes not a matter just of getting what you want or kicking ass. It's a matter of figuring out which ass you want to kick. And that's not easy. Yeah. We tend to sometimes kick the wrong one.
Very well said. All right, so there was one. You got 2 more.
never give up. Never, never, never give up. You know, I used to say, for example, in writing, that 2 rules of writing are, 1, stop talking about it. Just write. Stop telling your friends you're going to write a book. Write the book. Don't talk. The second rule is never give up. You know, the classic was J.K. Rowling getting turned down by, 13 different publishers. But don't give up. So many people have given up. Stop giving up. Persevere. It's not easy. It's painful. It's annoying. You know, I've been working on this for 20 years, and it's amazing how many people just don't see it. And now we're involved in trying to get the financing to take this to Alzheimer's trial. Well, if I give up, it definitely won't do. There, you know, Henry Ford was a real pain in the tush. I mean, what an obnoxious human being in many ways. But he's got all number of incredibly good quotes. And the classic was that one about that he came up with about whether you think you can do something or can't, you're right.
Well, yes.
You know, if you figure you're going to fail, you're going to fail. If you figure you're going to do it, you may still fail, but you better find out. When I was in high school, my guidance counselor told me I was stupid to go to college. Thank you very much for your opinion. thank you very much. Appreciate it. Kiss off. Yeah, never take no for an answer.
I love that one. All right, so you know what you asked to kick, and you never give up. And
well, as I say, just do it. That was part of the...
Oh, right. Just do it was the 3rd one. Okay, cool.
Yeah, don't talk about it. Don't say, you know, someday I'm going to learn a foreign language. No, that means you're not. Someday I'm going to travel the world. That means you're not. Someday I'm going to make $1 million. That means you're not. Someday I'm going to marry the right person and have kids. No, just do it. Stop yapping about it. Don't tell your friends. Don't put it on Facebook. Don't tweet it. Just do it. And if you want to go ahead and tell somebody afterwards or as you're doing, go right ahead. But talking about it and doing it are not the same thing. This is, you know, one of the things we've gotten involved in this whole Alzheimer's work is people come to us for interviews, and I had U.S. News and World Report call me. I said, don't mention my name, don't mention the biotech company, because whatever you do, I've got all these emails to answer. I don't want publicity. I want to get the work done. So I shouldn't be talking to you at all, David. So please don't tell them who I am and don't tell them anything about me.
But well, publicity
is not the same as getting the work done.
It's not the same as getting the work done, but you've done something that's actually a gift for people. And as a fellow author, you spend thousands and thousands of hours on writing a book. You condense so much of your life's work into this, and it takes someone 4 to 6 hours to read the average book. So in terms of leveraged time, there is no better leverage than buying a book for $20, because you're getting thousands of hours from an expert and it only takes 4 of your hours to absorb it. So publicity here is people should read your book because they'll learn the stuff, and the odds of them reaching out and talking to you are pretty low unless they're working for media and you're looking to sell more books, or hopefully to get some support, whether it's funding or regulatory support or whatever else for the studies you're doing, because it's important work and people should know important work is happening.
You remind me of a professor at Berkeley who we were talking about. I was writing a book. I was finishing writing the book. And she said, you know, writing a book is just like having a baby.
Yeah.
She said, at about 8 months through, one, you can't believe you've been at it for this long. Two, you can't believe it'll ever come to an end. And three, you cannot for the life of you remember why you agreed to do this in the first place.
Exactly. Having just turned my manuscript in about 3 weeks ago, I think I'm at that stage right now.
You've given birth. You're
yes.
happy now. I hope there's no sort of, you know, postnatal depression for you. I hope you're enjoying it.
I think my copper levels are high enough, but I do believe that I probably shortened my telomeres a little bit writing the book, because you know, running a company and writing a book all night long, every night for a while could do that, but it was worth it.
Oh, you fool, you. Good for you. Congratulations, David.
Well, likewise, congratulations on your book. And for listeners, it's called The Telomerase Revolution by Dr. Michael Fossel, Fossel. You can check that out on Amazon, anywhere else that they should go to find it.
It's also out in 7 languages and 10 global markets now.
Seven languages.
Two different Chinese editions, 3 English editions, French, I don't know what else, Russian, Spanish, whatever.
It must be in Japan, right?
Strangely enough, no. Although my first book 20 years ago was apparently a bestseller in Japan.
I got back from Japan 3 days ago, and it turns out The Bulletproof Diet is 160,000 copies, number one bestseller in Japan, and I had no idea, so I went there to do book signings. It was completely unpredicted, but I think they would love your book. So.
Oh, good for you.
Well, time to sell the rights.
My book will never pay the mortgage, never make me famous, but it was delightful doing it. Sounds like yours will do better, and I wish you the best.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you being on Bulletproof Radio, and have an awesome day.
You too. Thanks, David.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you know what to do. Head on over to your favorite bookseller and pick up a copy of The Telomerase Revolution. There's a lot you can do to live, maybe forever, certainly to live a lot longer than you were going to live if you did nothing. And that's what I'm doing, and you can join me in learning about that stuff on Bulletproof and read this book. Telomeres matter, mitochondria matter. Epigenetics, this idea that the environment around you changes your biology, is terribly important. And the idea that you can take control of that, biohacking, is really important. So by reading a few books like this, read The Bulletproof Diet, and read books by the dozens and dozens of other authors who've been on Bulletproof Radio, you can have a tool set that lets you not just live longer, but actually feel better, have more energy, and be a nicer person while you're living longer. And that's really the golden thing you can find here. So have a beautiful day. And if you like this episode, please head on over to iTunes and leave a 5-star review. Only takes you a second, and it actually matters. I look at those every day. Thank you.
Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.